Hi, welcome back to Jaffe Woodwinds. Today, our guest is a young lady who's had a wonderful and very full career already at still a very young age and has accomplished so much. Most people will know her as the principal flute for many years now, it's hard to believe, of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra. She's also had a long, distinguished career prior to the Met Opera, which we'll get into, but I'm just so thrilled to have this opportunity to talk with Chelsea Knox. And Chelsea, thank you for coming up here to Yamaha and being willing to participate in this interview series. And you know, I knew about you, heard about you when you were very young, because one of your great teachers, Greg Shearer, was a friend of my wife's and myself, and I remember him raving about you, and then we saw little tapes of you playing and then heard you play eventually. I think Jean, my wife, heard you and played with you and knew about you for many years before I actually heard you at the Met. And it's hard to believe all these years have passed because you still look so young and you've had such a full career already. But I do want to get into you know, your whole basically approach to music and the way music evolved in your life. So I know you grew up in the Litchfield, Connecticut area, which we live so close to now and love so much. And tell us a little bit about your upbringing and how music entered your life.
Yeah, well, thanks, first of all, for having me. It's really nice to get to talk to you today. And yeah, I grew up in Litchfield, Connecticut. I had a non-musical family, but a very supportive musical family. From a young age, they really got behind anything I was interested in. So I started out, our church had a music choir, and we also did a lot of Irish music. So I started out playing penny whistle, singing in the church choir, which led to vocal lessons, which led to singing in a children's choir that was based in Torrington, Connecticut, Chorus Angelicus. So I did that. Professional level children's choir for a number of years. And the leader of the children's choir was Paul Halley. He was married for a time to Rhonda Larson, the flute player.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
My gosh.
Yeah, so it was through that connection that I heard Rhonda play. She used to do concerts at the Milton Town Hall in Connecticut. Have you ever been there?
No, we haven't yet. I know about the concert series that they produced there, but yeah,
little tiny church.
Yeah, and it's funny, you know, when you mentioned that, I hadn't thought about Rhonda Larson for years, but I heard her, in a sense, debut recital at Carnegie Recital Hall. She had won, I don't know, it was a Concert Artist Guild or something. She had won and was presented there. And right away, I said, oh, my goodness, that is a very talented young lady. And she's gone on to have a wonderful career and a different type of career. But that's so interesting. I find it interesting also that vocal lessons were so much a part of your upbringing before you got into flute. And speaking with Paul Edmund Davies, the great English flute player and pedagogue, Paul also went to a school where he was trained as a singer. And he often talks about the fact how influential that was in his musical upbringing and his flute playing. As something to access. So that's great. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, it's great for ear training just to start to have that sense in your body of where pitches live. I think it helped a lot in my flute playing when I became more serious with the flute.
And when did you actually start playing flute?
I started in fourth grade when everybody was able to choose band instruments. I really wanted to play the trombone. My parents said, no. And they said, it's too big. You can play the flute. They played me a recording of James Galway playing Flight of the Bumblebee. And I said, okay, that's not so bad. I could do that.
I remember that recording. And you had already played penny whistle. So, I mean, if you heard that recording, I think there's some things with penny whistle that he did. I don't necessarily know on that recording, but, you know, it's an interesting parallel there. But you started in the school band, a school orchestra?
Yeah, school band, no orchestra in Litchfield Public Schools. But okay. I was so lucky to have really wonderful band teachers throughout my public school education who just allowed me to have the extra practice time built into public school, which I think really set me up her success.
Wow. Were any of them actually flute players themselves?
No. My high school band teacher, Steve Brooks, he still teaches in Connecticut. He was a saxophone player. But I want to say I had maybe 6 hours a day to practice at school. He was able to kind of build that into my schedule for me. I had independent study music, and I had band class. He didn't make me play
this
in the band.
This was a public school?
Yeah. I had independent study art classes. Somehow I managed. I practiced during lunch, and so somehow I practiced all day long at school.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And you did, and yet you had all the major subjects of the kids.
I guess I must have, but I think my aunt was the guidance counselor. And I told her early on, I was like, I'm going to be a musician, so I don't necessarily need calculus.
Wow.
maybe I should have.
Yeah. No, that's phenomenal. And when did you end up getting your own private flute teacher? When did that occur?
So when I was in middle school, I had started taking voice lessons. I'd started singing with this choir, and they suggested I should take piano lessons so that I could, you know, have some fundamental music skills. So I started taking piano lessons, but the piano teacher was taking a semester off, and he recommended a different piano teacher who also taught flute lessons.
Wow.
So before I knew it, I didn't really want to play piano. I wanted to play flute in the lessons, so I ended up switching to flute lessons, and from there, she recommended that I switch to Greg Shearer when I got to high school, and which was good timing. It's always good when a teacher knows that, like, I've taught you what I can, and now it's time for you to move on.
Absolutely. And when you studied with Greg initially during your high school years, was that in a pre-college situation, or was it just private lessons?
It started out as just private lessons, and then he encouraged me to take advantage of the different opportunities at Hart. There was the Connecticut Youth Symphony, and they had a certificate program which taught theory, ear training, and then I also did chamber music there. So I'm from Litchfield. I was driving back to Hartford almost every day of the week for different programs, but it was fantastic to have those opportunities.
Wow. Just a little plug for our friend Greg, who is the retired former principal flute of the Hartford Symphony and has had mentored many young flute players over the years, and successfully, and really a formidable musician, colleague, and friend. And you were very fortunate, because Greg is someone who really cares about his students, I know, and really cares about the tradition of flute playing. As well, and he comes from a great tradition of flute players. I know he studied with Harold Bennett and Julius Baker and Papasakis. So, I mean, that's wonderful that you had someone who is so versed in that and willing to share it and is aware of the contemporary flute playing scenario as well. So you had wonderful training early on. When did the idea of becoming a professional flutist, orchestral player, soloist, chamber player, when did that really sort of start fermenting in your mind?
Probably once I switched to studying with Greg. I think up until that point, I loved music, I loved singing, I loved the different aspects of music I was involved in, but once I started studying with Greg, I could see it as a possible future and a career, and that's kind of when all of my other interests sort of started to drop away, and I became really focused on doing what it would take to become.
And this is sort of around 14 or 15 years old?
Yeah, maybe a little younger. I was probably, I had a late for my year birthday, so I was probably 12 or 13 when I switched to studying.
So you were very focused very early on that. And you've already mentioned how much you practiced during your elementary school years in the school. Can you remember sort of the amount of time you devoted once you made that sort of decision in your mind, this is what I want to do? Do you remember sort of how much you practiced?
It was a lot. It was a lot of practice. And like I said, I was fortunate that I could build that into my school day. And I think Greg was also really helpful for me, because I was at that level where I started to wonder, should I be applying for Juilliard pre-college or going up to Boston to play in the youth orchestra there? Because Connecticut, you know, is the in-between land.
Right. Yeah.
I auditioned at Walnut Hill, the boarding school for music, and his stance was, yes, you can do these things, you can apply for them, but what you really need at this age is just time to practice, not time in the car driving all around to do all of these different things, which I think was great advice.
Good advice, yes.
Yeah, so I got a ton of experience at Hart, and I was able to get all of that practice time in.
Great. And knowing Greg's history, as we talked about, did you sort of develop some flute heroes? Were there certain flute players you really zeroed in on at that early age?
You know, speaking of Rhonda Larson, she was a huge flute hero of mine. I dressed up as her for Halloween one year when I was in middle school.
Really?
Yeah. She had, on the Free as a Bird album, she had this big white long dress.
Yes, yes.
So I wore that for Halloween.
That's so funny.
Yeah, so I think I loved her, and just the classic recordings, Galway and Rampal, Pahood, I just kind of devoured things at that age. I went to the Baker classes at Western Connecticut State
University. Wouldn't have been that far from you.
Yeah, close. I was able to just commute.
So that was for a number of summers that you did that?
I think I did two summers there. And just hearing other students there and hearing all of this repertoire was so inspiring. I went home and spent like $700 on Flute World. My parents were supportive of that.
but they must have
been a little like, okay. But I couldn't get enough. I just wanted to learn more music.
And just jumping ahead a little bit, was that when you first encountered Jeff Kaner? Because I know Jeff used to participate in those classes.
Yeah, that was when I first saw him teach. I don't think I got the chance to play for him when I was at the classes, but watching him teach, it all made so much sense to me. And that when I was applying for college, I really wanted to study with him. So I feel very fortunate that I got
And he went to the Juilliard School for undergrad and graduate work, all with Jeff there. And that was the driving force, because you wanted to study with him.
Yes. Yeah,
I think that's for many people. Going to a school, it's usually tied in with studying with a particular teacher. And that's great that you were able to see clearly and have those feelings. And Jeff, of course, is the principal flute for so many years of the Philly Orchestra, and prior to that, the Cleveland Orchestra, has built up a huge following and a huge several generations now of students of his who occupy so many of the principal positions in our country and internationally as well. Let's go back a little bit and talk about the pedagogy that you encountered first with Greg Shearer and then with Jeff. What were you introduced to pedagogically with Greg during your years prior to going to Juilliard?
I think both of them coming from that Baker School of teaching had similar fundamental ideas about flute playing, but both of them, I think, had a great way of not necessarily dictating what I had to sound like and more giving me the tools to teach myself. I think for Greg, like I said, I came in with all of this repertoire. I was like, I want to learn this. And he really did me such a great service by not stopping me. I think a lot of teachers would say, you're not ready. Because I was not ready, I was very young and I was just plowing through things. But he really allowed me to explore and.
But he must have seen, first of all, that you had the ability to negotiate that music on some level, and wanted to encourage that enthusiasm. Obviously, I don't think that's for everyone. I mean, some people might want to come in and say, "Yeah, I want to play the Dittia Sonatine. I want to do this," and they haven't played any Handel flute sonatas, and maybe could just accomplish some basic early Baroque stuff technically. I mean, obviously he saw that you had that ability and facility at that young age to perhaps do the more advanced, technically advanced compositions you were looking at. So. Your situation is somewhat unique, and we have to make sure that we don't, say this is the way it should go for everyone. I mean, but that's wonderful because, again, that's a teacher who has a experience and a bigger view of the situation. So yeah, you were fortunate there. What actual materials do you remember working with him on in those high school years? Let's say
I
Do you remember?
Oh my gosh, she's going to be upset with me because I don't really remember. I'm sure I know we did etudes. I know we played a lot of duets together, which I loved. And I have really happy memories.
You know, I have to also interject. My studies with Tom Neifinger, which were the most important for me on flute and among the most important with any teacher, we always played duets, and I couldn't wait for it because he would always make me play top line just to hear him play the bottom line and the huge sound and the fundamental aspect of sound that he was able to generate and make you sound better in doing it. But I look forward to that so much every lesson, which I didn't really have with just about any other teacher on any of my other instruments. But I think for teachers that playing with students and literally playing duets. I had that with my very first clarinet and sax teacher, Joseph Porcelli. He always played duets. You remember those duet books by Jaime Voxman called Selected Duets?
Oh, yeah.
Which were in many,
Still have mine.
I know, I do too. I love them. I couldn't wait for that to happen in my first years of playing. But in later years with Tom Neifinger, the same thing. And, and as I understand it, in France, that's a standard procedure in lessons, and also in all of the pedagogic materials coming out of France, you always see duets incorporated in those great works. Mm. So that's interesting. And then when you got to Juilliard and started your work with Jeff, do you remember any of those pedagogical materials?
Yes, I remember those more clearly because Jeff had a really clear regimen for his freshman students. When you were entering Juilliard, everybody did the same routine their freshman year, where you learned his method of scales, thirds, sixths, long tones, tonguing exercises, and then you brought in 4 etudes a week from a prescribed list of etude books.
Wow.
And then you moved on to the next week. And I think we had to memorize a Baroque sonata every week.
Every week?
I don't know if I did that the whole year. I think I did it for a while, and then he was like, okay,
I wanted to make sure I understand this. The warm-up exercises and things, technical third, sixth, scales, arpeggios, by memory.
Yeah.
4 etudes.
Not by memory.
Not by memory.
Thank goodness.
But a Baroque sonata by memory.
Yes.
Every week. Wow.
It was a lot of repertoire. Wow. And it was such a valuable lesson for me because it taught me how to get things done quickly and efficiently, which in the real world is absolutely a skill you need to have.
Right. That's very interesting. Now, I know Jeff had studied with Jeannie Backstresser early on before he with Baker. My impression was Mr. Baker was not as disciplined in his assignments, at least when I remember being at Juilliard. Julie was there. But, the Julius Baker book that was put out after he passed away, that was issued, which at the back of this book, it shows all of his notes on his lessons with Kincaid.
Hmm.
Are you familiar with that?
No.
Oh, I'm gonna get you that as a present.
Okay.
Okay? It's unbelievable. His handwritten notes on every lesson he took with Kincaid. And believe it or not, the etudes that he worked on initially with Kincaid were the Berbigua. And he would write his notes on every little detail Kincaid would admonish him on or recommend. It's very interesting. So it seemed like Kincaid was very, very, very specific and detailed in his lessons. So that's interesting that Jeff sort of follows suit in that way. That's great. And during your years at Juilliard, were you thinking more in terms of an orchestral career or, of course, with Ron Paul starting it and Galway continuing the evolution of the solo flute career? Did you have any thoughts in either direction at that time?
I loved playing an orchestra, being part of a team. I was always interested in other genres of music too. So I played guitar when I was at Juilliard. I collaborated a lot with dancers. I played guitar for some dancers. I played flute for some dancers. I did some moderate improvising. I would not say I'm any sort of skilled in jazz, but I enjoy listening.
Great.
I like learning about different things. So my goal while I was at Juilliard was to just take every opportunity I could get. So I played in the new music ensemble. I said yes, basically, to anything that came my way. Because I didn't really know where I wanted to end up after school, but I wanted to be playing music
Now, today, in so many of the conservatories and conservatories within a larger liberal arts school, so much of the focus, not only for the flute studios, but for all the woodwinds, except saxophone, is geared to orchestral excerpts. And in fact, master's degrees, we only are dealing with orchestral excerpts and the idea that this is going to win you a job. How much were orchestral excerpts a part of your study when you were going through your undergrad and grad work?
Not a whole lot. I actually appreciate that Jeff didn't, he would let us bring in excerpts if we had an audition. That was kind of the only time we were allowed to bring excerpts into lessons.
Wow.
Which I think was healthy, because then our focus, so after you get through that first year of the gauntlet of etudes and baroque sonatas and fundamental exercises, then you bring in a new piece of repertoire every week with piano, like a recital, every week something new, which also was great experience.
That's fantastic. And you had a piano accompanist, a collaborative pianist assigned to the studio?
No, we just had to kind of wing it every week.
You had to find your own.
Yeah, so I remember one traumatic week where my pianist did not show up and he said, come back with the pianist. And I had to leave and I cried in the bathroom. And then a pianist walked in. I said, what will you play? She said, I'll play Bach. And I ran to the library. I got Bach E minor or something. And I went back and finished my lesson sight reading a Bach.
I often had to find pianists for my lessons many, many years before yours. But now I think they have a collaborative piano department there.
Yes.
So I would imagine it maybe easier to find.
It's a little easier, but I think the challenge is still they get paid minimum wage for the hour lesson, but they have to learn something like the Nielsen Concerto to accompany you on. It's challenging to find a pianist who is willing to learn some of the harder flute repertoire for just one hour experience.
Yes, I still go through that over the years since I graduated, trying to find pianists who want to play the saxophone repertoire. Poor people. It's hard. But all that being said, it sounds like you really at Julia got the full experience between orchestral playing, the studio work with Jeff, and then playing all the other extra classes and ensembles there at Julia. So now, after you graduated, you were successful in a number of auditions that led you to be playing assistant in Baltimore and principal in New Haven, and so. How did you go about preparing for the audition since your degrees weren't geared specifically towards orchestral excerpt playing and winning a job in that fashion?
Well, I should mention that I quit the flute. After I finished my master's degree, I took a job playing the ocarina. I was like, this flute thing's been real, but I'm a little burnt out. Auditions are stressful. I'm not sure I want to do this. I need a break. I at least needed a break, but it ended up being a year of... I did this ocarina job for a little while, and then...
Wait a minute, there were jobs playing ocarina?
It was advertised in the union paper, I thought I'd give it a try.
I thought that stopped with the Popeye cartoons.
It ended up being a lot of comic conventions where I dressed up like Zelda with the fake ears and stuff.
Oh, man.
But, so I came back to New York in the fall of that year. Work started picking back up. Actually, I have to credit Jasmine Choi, because I think she saved my life. She called me and asked me to play a double concerto with her, and I was like, this is it. I can be a flute player again. So
did she know that you had stopped for the year?
I don't know. Maybe Jeff had told her. I'm not sure. I don't know if I ever asked her. But we never ended up getting to do it because it was the weekend Hurricane Sandy hit, and it was canceled. God. But it was enough to get me to move back to New York and start playing the flute again. So I came back to New York. I was dead broke. I was living on a friend's rented sofa in Harlem, and I got a job working at a picture framing shop down in Chelsea. I was doing that 9 to 5. And amidst this kind of turmoil year where I was trying to figure out what I really wanted and how flute fit into that, there were a couple auditions that came up for New Haven Symphony and Princeton Symphony, like within a couple weeks of each other. So I was working my picture framing job, and I was biking home to Brooklyn. I had moved from Harlem to Brooklyn. I was practicing for, you know, an hour before I passed out from exhaustion. And I was finding that I was doing a lot of my practice mentally instead of with my flute in my hands, because I just didn't have time to practice like how I had been when I was in college and high school. But for me, it changed my perspective on audition taking, where before I had been so nervous and I had so much pressure on myself to succeed. I found the joy in the excerpts. I found the joy in listening to the symphonies that the excerpts were from. For me, it made it a positive experience taking auditions, switching over from a kind of negative, stressful experience. So when I took those first couple auditions for Princeton and New Haven, I didn't really have expectations. I just was happy to be playing again. I was hoping I could be part of the team because I missed that part of music making, the team aspect of it.
Sure.
And I was really fortunate that I was able to get both of those, because between the two of them, it was enough for me to quit my picture framing job and start playing full time again.
Wow, what an interesting journey. I knew nothing about any of that. That's interesting. And so now you're playing principal in these two regional orchestras. And you started finding the joy again, as you said. But obviously, those type of jobs throughout the country don't pay enough to live on full time. So as you were working through these jobs, were you now looking at the union paper and saying, well, let me see what bigger jobs are coming up? Did that start to develop?
Yeah, definitely. I was making enough money to like cover my gas and my rent, but that was about it. It was not the most comfortable existence, but I got such great experience in those two orchestras. Right. I met great people, and they were such supportive groups. And I think I needed that at that point in my career, coming off of being not sure if I was going to play at all, right, and then suddenly having colleagues that made me feel like right, I could do this. I have something to offer.
Right. And you're in your mid-20s this point. So that, you know, that's a big that's a very important time of life for most people. You know, you're at the crossroads. Where am I going? How does this fit into my life goals? So it was very fortunate you won those auditions and then got the bug again, in a good way. So then how did the Baltimore Symphony job evolve?
So Baltimore, I auditioned, I want to say in October of 2014. And then I had a trial week, and then I had another trial week, and then I had a trial year, and then I finally went on tenure track. So after coming from Princeton and New Haven, where it felt like it was just everyone was happy to have me there, I didn't quite have the same experience in Baltimore. I had to fight a lot harder. And I think it helped me get some thicker skin. It helped me, find some of my weaknesses in my playing and work on those. So when I was in Baltimore and the Met audition came up, I had been working on myself. I had been working on my playing to learn how to play in a bigger space and with a bigger group and that sound that they were looking for.
Now you were assistant principal, am I correct, in Baltimore? Okay. And any type of job like that pays, you know, a good livable salary for a musician. Yes, and people have been there for decades, many of them, and some are, you know, and there's always that angst that, you know, is inevitable no matter what group one is in. But you were still single at this time?
You had married
already?
Yeah, well, I got married while I was in Baltimore, but my husband still lived in Brooklyn. So I had a lot of pressure to come back to New York Met audition came around.
Okay.
So my first year in Baltimore, the Met held a one-year audition for principal. And that audition, I was runner-up. So I had learned all the repertoire, and I knew when the full permanent tenure track audition came the year after that I would be ready for it. I was very committed.
Now, let's just take a brief stoppage here for a second and mention that you're in the Baltimore Symphony, and most of the excerpts I would imagine that you did work on with Jeff or consider were orchestral excerpts. Now you're dealing with very different repertoire with the opera. So when the Met edition, the initial edition came up and was posted, now you had a whole different repertoire to learn. Had you been involved with playing operas before that audition? Had you had any experience? Did you look at any of the opera excerpt publications? I mean, it's a big step. It's not a segue. I mean, that's a big different repertoire to learn.
That's true. I had not played a whole lot of opera, but I loved opera. When I was at Juilliard, I went to the Met all the time. I went to the HD broadcasts when I was in Baltimore. My mother's mother was a big opera fan. So she had given me like the librettos to Wagner operas and a brick from the original Met Opera House.
Oh,
and
gosh.
So I had exposure to opera repertoire from a young age, from Hartford Opera too. I would go and see, I remember seeing Greg play Lucia there and thinking like, I would like to do this.
Yeah.
So when the Met audition came around, I knew it was something I was very interested in.
Okay. And then when you won the audition, obviously you made the transition back here to New York and joined the Met. What was that experience like playing in an opera orchestra as opposed to a symphonic orchestra where you're in a pit, as wonderful as the Met pit is, and it's a great sounding pit. I mean, just as an acoustic sound, but it's still in a pit, but as opposed to being on stage. And the different repertoire. How did you deal with those different circumstances?
There's a slightly different mindset, I think, for the musicians at the Met from a stage orchestra. And we feel it when we switch to Carnegie mode, when we do our touring and our stage performing. When you're rehearsing for stage performances, you're practicing to execute again at that really high level where everything locks in and goes according to plan. But when you're rehearsing for opera repertoire, you're really practicing listening to each other and being flexible. And in the pit, that's such a high priority for everyone, that chamber music mentality of catch the singers, catch each other, work together, and the spotlight's not on us. So there's a little bit less pressure in a way. I think it gives us the freedom to listen and collaborate as our top priority.
Right. And the ability to be flexible is paramount, and certainly in chamber music, but certainly dealing with singers in different casts and of course, different conductors. I mean, you have to be on your toes all the time, I would imagine. A dear friend of mine who used to be principal clarinet at the Met many years, Joe Rabai, we'd often talk about that. He was a neighbor of mine as well as a mentor, and he really enjoyed that to a degree, except on the clarinet when you have to change pitch and go up. You know, he was one of the first to deal with the movable barrel, so he could quickly change the pitch if the singer is, you know, in another tonality for a moment. But yeah, it's interesting that you bring up the idea of the chamber music flexibility. Because really, for all music, we have to be that way. I mean, regardless of where you are, but it's paramount in chamber music and as you mentioned, in an opera orchestra. Now, the Met is our nation's most famous, well-established, and greatest opera company. But their schedule is ridiculous. I mean, for every person involved. So, can you talk a little bit about what that schedule is like for those who maybe not as familiar with that and how you navigate that on a personal level and emotional level, I mean, a physical level, just to keep up physically and mentally and on top of all the music. So first tell us about what the Met schedule is when you're in season and, you know, Monday through Sunday, what it's like.
Yeah, so during the Met season, we have 7 operas a week and then we have rehearsals during the day. Sometimes every day, Monday through Friday.
And they're not the same, it's not the same opera, seven opera performances. It's usually at least 3 or 4,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. I think my record was 8 different operas in 1 week during transition week.
Oh, gosh.
Where we like closed a couple, opened a couple. Yeah. So that amount of repertoire is a big change from symphonic repertoire where you're learning a week's worth of music and then on to the next and on to the next. Right. And with opera music, you're learning a much longer work, but then you have maybe a month or a half a year that you will be performing the same operas over. It gives you a different trajectory to the way you learn and then the way you grow with the repertoire while you're playing it.
And because of the extraordinary amount of music and the time that operas typically last, there's you have another first flute to help you with that as well, so that you're not doing all of those operas all the time. I mean, I don't think a human could last that. It would. It's just unbelievable. So, to you, what is a typical week like as far as the amount of rehearsals and operas that's on your plate?
Yeah. So, like you said, I have an amazing co-principal, Seth Morris, and teamwork is the name of the game at the Met, because we have a great section all around. Maroon Curry and Stephanie Mortimer also in the section. I'm so lucky because it really takes all four of us to cover everything. And sure. I've been so lucky that they are just the best for working that out. And Seth and I sit down at the beginning of each season, and some of the operas we can switch in and out of, Bohème, Traviata, the standard repertoire that comes back, sometimes dozens of those operas throughout the season. Usually we can jump in and jump out whenever we need to. Some of the more heavy-hitting operas, the Strauss programs or Wagner, we have to stick on that opera. Only one of us plays the entire run. So then it becomes a little bit of a jigsaw puzzle where we go through, we start with our non-switching operas, the ones that we will be locked into, and then we kind of piece together the non-switching operas.
Right. Yeah. And so, but you're doing eight services a week, basically, right?
The nice thing about the Met is that there's actually quite a bit of flexibility. As long as our contract is for four shows a week. So as long as we're playing our four shows a week, rehearsals are paid extra. We're actually kind of like a per service gig in that way.
I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. So it's something kind of unique to our contract language, but it does allow for week, day-to-day flexibility in a way that stage orchestras don't have. Usually you're assigned a program for the week. You have to be there for all the rehearsals, all the shows for that week. But with the Met, you could play rehearsal show Monday and rehearsal show Tuesday, and then be off Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then play a double show Saturday and have your four shows the week.
I see.
We find ways to, like for me, now that I have kids, I prefer not to drive into the city twice in one day or not to stay in the city all day if I don't have to. So Seth and I try to work it out where we don't have too many double services, or we try to make the workload humane for both of us.
So let's just segue for a second to your family. You mentioned, you know, when you were in Baltimore, your husband was in Brooklyn. All right, now you land the Met job, and you have, if I'm not mistaken, three children.
Yeah.
And one set of twins and the third. Okay, the Met schedule is difficult enough. Now you're commuting, and you live in Westchester, about an hour away. And how do you possibly manage with, and they're young children, these are not teenagers. I mean, you're dealing with young children. How do you manage with three children plus the responsibility of this incredible job at the Met?
Oh, my husband, really, he's the best. He's really allowed me to have my career to this level. I wouldn't be able to do it without him. He's sacrificed a lot for our family.
And he's a musician as well.
Yeah, he's a cellist. So I'm very, very lucky that he's been so supportive of me and our kids and our family, because it's made it all possible.
Right. I mean, I can't see how any one human being could possibly do that.
Yeah.
At all. And so in managing being a mother and being in one of the hot seats of in all classical music, principal flute at the Met Opera, that takes a lot of discipline and a lot of coordination. And so I imagine some of the discipline that you received, as you mentioned with Jeff in your studies, some of that may have rubbed off on how you go about your daily life in order to accomplish all this.
Absolutely. I think if I did not have that discipline and that ability to learn repertoire quickly and efficiently, I would be a fish out of water in this job.
Right. Yeah. it's quite astonishing. But you also have other hobbies that I've heard about, and I experienced going to your website and seeing you're a wonderful artist, that your oil paintings are really stunning. So let's talk about how you evolved as an artist, as a hobby of yours.
So my mom is a visual artist. She's a landscape painter. And growing up, there was always art around in our house. And actually, when I went to take flute auditions for college, that was the only thing kind of holding me back, was I was not sure if I wanted to double major in visual art as well. And ultimately, flute won out, but it was always something I kept dabbling in. During the pandemic, when the Met shut down, I suddenly had kind of a creative vacuum. And so I had time to paint, and it became my artistic outlet when there was no flute playing because nobody wanted respiratory particles near them.
Yeah, quite amazing. And actually, it might be just a cute little anecdote, excuse me, that on the night, and now I have not talked to you about this, but my wife has told me that, if I'm correct, that on the night the Met shut down, the first night of the pandemic, you were pregnant and you gave birth at that period. I mean, of all days, I mean, that's
March 11th, 2020. It was during the last show the Met played. I was supposed to play Cosi that night. I was like, I think I'm in labor. Can you guys do it without me?
Oh, my goodness.
Which was good. Was this when you had the twins? No, this was my older one, Adderley.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. All right. Wow. A confluence of all these factors. But you seem to be able to be the type of person who can weather stress and take things in stride and somehow get through to the other side.
I'm learning.
Yeah. But that's also what being a parent is about. And you've obviously accomplished that quite well. So let's go back now to the flute playing, and now that you've been at the Met a number of years, what opera repertoire do you find to be the stuff that you lock into best, that you enjoy the most?
This is such a hard question for me because I really love it all. I was thinking about it. I love playing Strauss. It's such a challenge. I think some of my most profound performances at the Met have been Strauss, but then I think Mozart. I love playing Mozart. There's just, the repertoire is so
it's
wonderful. Yeah. And I love playing Bel Canto, even though, some people at the Met, I think of Bel Canto and they want to go to sleep. But I love that repertoire too. There's so much. I'm just a big opera nerd. I love it all. Spielen, selbst wilde Tiere Freude fühlen. Wie stark ist doch dein Zaubertum, deine holde Flüte durch deine Spiele. Alle Flüte durch dein Spielen, selbst wilde Tiere Freude. Doch nur Amira bleibt davon, nur Amira bleibt davon.
Do you ever get the desire to start singing again?
No. I have stress dreams about having to go up on stage at the Met. I'll stay in the pit with the flute. Thank you.
that's funny. But you are hearing some of the greatest voices in the world on a daily basis. It must be incredibly inspiring in that regard. Now, before I want to talk about your teaching a little bit, but in adapting to not only the changing repertoire from day to day, but also the changing conductors. Whereas, and you know, orchestras today, even the resident conductor is, if they're there half a season, that's a lot. But at the Met, every week you're going to be dealing with 3-4 different conductors, I would imagine. How does one adapt to that? Because every conductor has a different style of technique and communication. That's an added level of concern. Mm-hmm. How do you deal with that, and how have you learned to deal with that?
Yeah, I think when I first started at the Met, I took the conductors maybe too literally. I was looking for time being beaten, and
Oh no, that's right.
Yeah, I think some of the best conductors at the Met are the conductors that just really feel the singers and connect with the singers in a way where, like, they're switching into subdivisions and big beats, and you don't even notice it because they're feeling the music in such an organic way that you can do your part without even really thinking about the conductor.
Right. And how much do you listen to, let's say, in your preparation for doing an opera? Not one that's brand new and that you're learning on the fly, as everyone else has, but standard opera that maybe you hadn't encountered before you got to that. What was your learning process for these operas?
Yeah, like all the Puccini repertoire is so difficult when you're playing it for the first time. I would listen to dozens of recordings. I would play along with recordings because I found that if I could play along with a recording, by the time I got into rehearsal, I probably didn't need to rely on the conductor for geography. I could participate right in a more meaningful way. So part of my preparation is always playing an opera with a recording at least a few times before I
That's very interesting. And I think certainly, I know for orchestral editions, players do that uniformly. Mm-hmm. And but the opera repertoire is so vast. And again, these operas are not a 25-minute concerto, even a one-hour opera. We're talking a one-hour symphonic work. We're talking about on the small side, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, Wagner operas. I mean, my gosh, from the outside, it just seems an overwhelming task.
Yeah, I have to really structure my time leading up to a new opera. I have to make sure that I budget enough time to go through all of the acts of like a 6-hour Wagner opera. I can't start learning it a couple right weeks before. I have to really be already thinking about it half a year before so that I have enough time to digest it and understand
it. And the Met season is established how far in front?
Usually we get the season sometime in the winter of the year ahead.
So and then about 7-8 months?
Yeah, and Seth and I do our schedule in the summer leading up to the season, so I won't know exactly what operas I'm playing until maybe a month or two before the season starts. Right. But I try to learn almost everything just so I'm prepared if anybody gets sick. We're all part of the same team, so right, we want to be able to help each other.
Yeah, and the Met may have as many as 20 different operas in the season, or in that regard. I mean, it's astonishing, and just to see them, changing sets even on double show days. It's an incredible house. I mean, astonishing that they are able to accomplish what they are able to do there. Really, let's jump a little bit to your teaching. And last year you started teaching at Curtis alongside your mentor, Jeff, there. And what experience had you had in teaching before you began at Curtis last year?
I had taught during the summer. I had taught at the Verbier Festival and part of NYO's mm-hmm. Carnegie Hall youth program, and mostly to other professional level flute players. So since starting the Met, I hear a lot of people with their audition lists when they're in the final stages getting ready for auditions.
Right.
So this is my first time teaching at the collegiate level, and I'm so lucky to be learning alongside Jeff because he's still teaching me, he's still guiding me on and now this new chapter.
Right.
but it's been wonderful. The students are right.
So how do you and Jeff Kaner divide up the students at Curtis? Are there still the four flutes at one time?
There are five.
There are five now, yeah. Okay. Is that all, by the way, is that true on all the instruments? Because years ago, my recollection was that they would only allow four in on each orchestral woodwind for a number of years, but now it's five?
I'm not sure, actually. That's okay. A good question.
Okay, all right, but it's interesting. All right, so there are five flute players, and there's still one orchestra, right? Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Yeah. All right, so how do you divide up the five? Are you seeing them on a weekly basis or a bi-weekly basis?
So the way we divide it is we all both teach all five students, and then we just split weeks. So okay. Jeff might teach 2 or 3 weeks a month, and I'm down for a week or two a month. And that makes it possible for me with my Met schedule right now. I'm glad to be down there and getting to work with the students.
And right. And I imagine there's a lot of collaboration with you and Jeff to coordinate on what each student is working on and the progress so that it flows in a natural manner.
I think because I studied with Jeff and I know kind of his system, I know what freshman students do, and I know what the expectations are after that they come in every week with a fully prepared new repertoire every week with pianists. So, you know, there's not as much, we don't necessarily need to discuss what everybody's doing. It's they just need to show up prepared.
And does he still have that same, rigid list of what each, from week to week?
I don't think it's as hard as it used to be.
Oh, really?
This year I was like, where's your Baroque memorized sonata? And the student was like, I didn't know I had to do that. I was like, oh, maybe it's gotten, maybe I'm, I don't know, maybe my memory is faulty and it wasn't as dramatic as I remembered, or maybe he's gotten softer.
Well, the success rate, especially you're dealing with the top young flute players in the country of a certain age at Curtis, and of course at Juilliard, but especially at Curtis, I mean, it's so clear that an orchestral career is why you're there for woodwind players. And so I would imagine that intense discipline approach and the demand on learning the fundamentals in a real solid way is wonderful to hear. Now, has he broadened the concept of using orchestral excerpts more as part of a lesson? Is that, do you see that in any way, or is it still sort of similar to what you experienced?
I think it's still sort of similar, and I think that's a good thing. I think so much of finding your own musical voice comes from playing the repertoire, playing big juicy lines and whole pieces, and excerpts are so fragmented that I'm also encouraging students to find their musical identity by playing as much variety of repertoire as possible.
Great. That's great. Yeah, I as an outsider sort of looking back and looking in, and sort of the way I've always approached or did approach all my instruments, flute, clarinet, saxophone, was always playing, you know, etudes and the repertoire and any chamber music that was possible, which I always felt was the most important. And I actually think I learned the most playing in chamber ensembles. Do they have a great deal of chamber ensemble work at Curtis?
You know, because I'm only there for lessons, I don't actually know the full offering of opportunities for students. I'm still kind of learning the ropes.
I see.
As I go, because I didn't go there myself. So it's all a little new for me still.
Right. Well, it's great that they have both you and Jeff there, generations or so apart, and someone's toward the end of his career, someone in the midst of their career, and I would imagine the perspective they're getting from both of you can only be positive and give them a realistic view of the music industry and the orchestral world as well as the opera world. Let's now just go off the topic. We're up here at Yamaha. Our friend and brilliant repair technician Tomoji Hirakata is here recording us, and you, I know, have had a great deal to do with the development and in the something to look forward to in the Yamaha flutes to come. Can you talk about your experience with flute? What was the first flute you played, and how did you end up playing Yamaha?
Yeah, so I started out playing, well, I guess I had something I started on. I don't even remember, maybe a Miyazawa, but I switched to Burkhart when I was studying with Greg. He played Burkhart. He encouraged me to go up there and try flutes, and I found one I loved. I played on that all through college. I won my first couple jobs on that flute. And then when I won the job in Baltimore and I had my trial week, I went down for my first trial week and my flute wasn't working. And I called Greg and I said, help me, my flute's not working. And he gave me another Burkhart that was a 440 scale. And Baltimore played at 440 and I instantly felt so much more comfortable. I had never really thought about the scale of a flute before making that much of a difference.
What was the scale on your first Burkhart?
It must have been 442. That's kind of the standard scale, unless you are seeking out a 440 flute. So I borrowed Greg's 440 flute. I did this trial week. It felt really nice. I decided I was going to explore other 440 flutes. So I went up to Burkhart. They said, we don't really do this anymore. I went to Brannon. They said, we can make you one, but you have to pay for it first and then see how it comes out. And I said, I don't know. So I talked to Jeff because I was like, I know you have a 440 flute. And he gave me a Yamaha to try. And I had already been playing on a Yamaha head joint for quite some time, since maybe halfway through college. I remember, actually, I think I was with Tomoji when I tried it. And I picked it up and it was like a Harry Potter moment where the wand chooses the wizard, where it just felt like, oh, I was like, this is it.
And I have to interject because I honestly believe, in playing sax, clarinet, flute, I was sort of an equipment nut for so many decades. But in thinking back over it, especially over the last decade, every instrument that I ended up really loving, every piece of equipment, a mouthpiece, a headdress, it was always the initial way it struck me, the emotional reaction, the musical reaction. My flute that I've been playing for 35 years, someone brought it to the house. The first few notes I played it, I said, man, this is wonderful. And every time I hesitated and I said, well, maybe this will work out and whatnot, it never worked out. It was always the initial reaction. So I'm so happy to hear that was your reaction too for that Yamaha head joint. Because I think sometimes we overanalyze equipment, or we'd say, "Well, this great player is playing that equipment. I gotta have it." And boy, did I do that for so long. You never know what's going to strike you, and it when it hits, you know it immediately. It's so true. But I'm sorry to interrupt, but it just, you know, got me thinking immediately about the way I felt playing the equipment, especially the flute I've been playing for 35 years now. So now you're playing the Yamaha flute on a Burkhart body.
Yes.
All right. What got you to transition to the entire Yamaha flute?
Yeah, so I tried Jeff's 440 scale Yamaha flute, and it just felt like the right fit. I had the 14 karat gold Type K head joint and a silver Yamaha 440 scale body, and I felt really comfortable. I think the week I got it, I went and took an audition on it and got to the end, and I was like, if I can do this on just a couple days on this instrument, I think this will do. And yeah, I've been on it ever since. I actually have two of the exact same flute because I can't. I don't like switching and change.
So smart
with the Met schedule.
I have. Oh man, you'll appreciate this. I would never interject this, but it's a lesson for everybody. At one time, I had three flutes that I loved, equally loved. One was a Brannon. That actually had been Julius Baker's Brannon. Long story beside that, and I'll tell you at dinner about that. Julius Baker's Brannon, I had a Haynes flute, which was my first top-level professional flute. It was a good one. And a Powell, a standard Powell. I had them, and they were all C-foot, because as a commercial player, I always gravitated to the C-foot. Ron Powell did it, so why not? All right. So I was playing a show. I think when I was playing the show, a chorus line, and the first book had these beautiful flute solos especially one that Jonathan Tunick had arranged on a tune called At the Ballet. It starts with a flute solo with harp, I think, background. And each flute had a different had different tendencies, even though they were all 440. You know, one would be the open C sharp would be higher than another one. The other one, the A, was a little lower than this one. So I remember getting ready to play, okay, what was, and I forgot the tendency of the flute that I was playing. And I was going through this because it was a few minutes before. And I completely freaked out. I can't remember what the tendency of this flute is. After that show, I said, no, this has got to stop. I decided at that time, I think I held on to the Powell. I had sold the Brannan, I sold the Haynes, and then I eventually got the Powell that I'm playing now. And there was a very great woodwind doubler in town, Harvey Estrin. I don't know if you know. He was married to Trudy Kane while she was at the Met. And Harvey always said, play one instrument, one flute, learn the tendency of every note. What every note is going to, how it's going to speak for you, how the pitch is, the volume. He said when you start adding layers of instruments, you're adding complexity that will hurt you in the end. And I learned that on the spot. So I couldn't agree more with you that if you love an instrument and want to get a backup, which it should be as similar as possible. It's so important from day to day and just making life a little bit less stressful, you know. So now, in playing the Yamaha flute over the many years now, what have you learned about them and what things are in the cards for the future and things that you want to, add to the flute?
No, I am pretty darn content. I love my flute. I think what we were talking about where you pick it up and you just feel that instant, right. Like, this is right. I think when I play it, I feel like this is how... like the sound that I hear in my head that I want to sound like. So, I'm so lucky Tomoji keeps it in such great shape too. I don't want for anything.
Yes. And I'm still waiting. I know 3 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, there was a prototype of a new Yamaha flute that they came here to the States with. And I remember trying here, which completely knocked me out. It was a 0.018 tube, which is the same weight as a, Platinum or commercial model of Powell, for instance, had a more traditional head cut, offset G, I remember playing it, and even though I mentioned I've been playing my flute for 35, 36 years, this was the first flute that I played that gave me the same thrill, and I said, I think it's even better. It was everything. And I've been begging Yamaha. So please, if you're watching this at Yamaha, please put that flute out. It was just spectacular. And, and really turned my head around. And but also, you mentioned, about Tomoji and how keeping the flute in great repair is so essential. And I just as a little addendum to our interview for our viewers, having a repair technician, or if depending on where you live, several technicians, if you play multiple instruments, if you're a doubler, having a great technician to work on your instruments is one of the most important things you can have as a professional musician or as an aspiring professional musician. It is essential. There's no ifs, ands, or buts, because instruments, no matter how well you maintain them and how well they're repaired, over time, every 6 months or so, something is going to go a little awry. And if you're playing a lot like Chelsea is every night under, great pressure and, really exposed as a principal player, well, it goes without saying that you must have your instrument in the top shape. So there's a little addendum. If you're someone who... skeptical about, well, I don't have to bring my horns in more than once a year. No. If you're a player, your technician is your best friend. Mm-hmm. They are. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. And but that's, thank you for mentioning Tomoji's work with your flute. Yes. What projects or things are you looking forward to doing? I know the Met is going to be on tour this summer, and we're going to be seeing you in Paris when you're there, just coincidentally. And that's another thing, by the way, that the Met Opera Orchestra also performs as a symphonic orchestra. They do concerts at Carnegie Hall a number of times during the year and on tour. What's coming up this fall for the Met Opera Orchestra? Tell us about the tour in Europe and what's coming up this next year.
Yeah, so one of the nice things about the Met is that we do get guaranteed this chunk in the summer. So myself and most of my Met colleagues are busy other places in the summer season. So this summer I'll be going out to teach at Aspen for the first time at the music
Wow,
festival there.
that's
Yeah, and
great.
play in the chamber orchestra and the festival orchestra there. We have this time in the summer, so I'll be playing with a couple different orchestras. I'm going out to play with Dallas Symphony in Vail and Chicago Symphony in Ravinia. So I'm
Great.
filling up my summer with more playing, which is what I love to do, but it's different repertoire, it's different meeting new people.
Right.
So I'm looking forward to those opportunities. And come fall, it'll be back to business. First, we have a tour in Europe. We're going to London, the Proms, and then Lucerne in Switzerland and Paris. To finish our tour, we'll be doing a Strauss program and a Mahler program on that tour. And once we get back, I think we start the season with Verdi Macbeth, a new Missy Mazzoli opera, Lincoln and the Bardo, which I'm curious about because I've read the book. And yeah, it looks like another great season. And I'll start back up at Curtis again. So that'll be I'm still learning how to balance and find
Yeah,
time
but
between
I mean, quite
all of it.
frankly, I keep thinking back. This is before I think you were born, probably. But I keep thinking you should be wearing the Linda Carter Superwoman outfit in managing all of these things. I mean, and three kids, husband, a family, a house, the gig, touring, teaching. I mean, there are not many people, Chelsea, I don't think, who could manage all of that and do it as well as you do it. I really, I
Great
mean,
support. That's really how it's
yeah, I
possible.
mean, it's something. And we hope that many of you will, who are listening now, when you come to New York, or if you're in New York, will get a chance to visit the Met Opera. It's one of the great institutions of culture in our country. And we need more people, especially young people, exposed to opera and exposed to this magnificent organization. And when you do, I hope you'll be able to hear Chelsea and certainly come down to the pit and tell her if you've seen the interview. But thanks so much for doing this. I
Thanks for having me.
really appreciate it. And continued great luck. And just keep doing what you're doing. We're all going to be better for it. Okay, thanks. And thank you for watching JoffeyWoodwinds.com, and please come back for our next interview. Thank you.
Thanks.